Hello everyone, my name is Elijah David. This is the 12th Hour Cross Valley Sabbath Training Congregation out of the 12th Hour in Liberty Hill, Texas. Today is August 27, 2016, or it is Hebrew 25, 2020. We're going to start our third service on this Sabbath day with a song entitled Untrodden Day. They tell me of a home far beyond the sky. Oh, they tell me of a home far away. Oh, they tell me of a home where no sunflowers rise. Oh, they tell me of an untrodden day. Oh, the land of flawless day. Oh, the land of an unflooded day. Oh, they tell me of a home where my friends have come. Oh, they tell me of an unflooded day. Oh, they tell me of a home where my friends have gone. Oh, they tell me of that land far away, where the trees of love eternally bloom. Shed this fragrance through the unclouded day. Oh, the land of the cloudless day. Oh, the land of an unflooded day. Oh, they tell me of a home where no storm clouds rise. Oh, they tell me of the unflooded day. Oh, they tell me of a king and his beauty there. And they tell me that my eyes shall be whole while he sits on the throne that is whiter than snow. In the city that is made of gold, at the end of cloudless day. Oh, they tell me of a home when no storm has rise. Oh, they tell me of an unflooded day. Oh, they tell me that he smiles on his children there. And his smile drives the sorrow all away. And they tell me that no tears ever come again. In that lovely land of unflowered day, you're the one that of this day. Oh, the land of an unflowered day. Oh, they tell me that he smiles on his children there. In the land of the unflooded day. Part four, dealing with To the Seven Churches, track 15 of Viti Hardas, we're in The Breaking of the Seventh Seal now, page 63. Our prayer thought for this service is taken from our memory verse, is taken from Matthew 5:48. Be ye therefore perfect, even as your Father which is in heaven is perfect. Ezekiel 28:15. Thou wast perfect in thy ways, from the day that thou wast created till iniquity was found in thee. Okay. Talking about Lucifer. And he's created in heaven as a covering cherub. Now in Job 1:1 it says, "There was a man in the land of Uz whose name was Job, and that man was perfect, and upright, and one that feared Yahweh and eschewed evil." Okay, now it says there in Genesis 6:9, these are the generations of Noah. Noah was a just man and perfect in his generations, and Noah walked with Yahweh. In Genesis 17:1, "And when Abraham was 90 years old, Yahweh appeared unto Abram and said unto him, I am the Almighty Elohim. Walk before me and be thou perfect." Okay, now, so what is that telling us? Let's go to Deuteronomy 32, verse 4. "He is the rock. His work is perfect, for all his ways are judgment." A deity, or an Elohim of the truth, and without iniquity, just and right is he. Now that's what we want to be said about us. That all of our ways are judgment. We're a person of the truth and without iniquity. So we know that David, had iniquity. We know that he got forgiven of all his iniquity, became considered perfect. And so now, it says in Psalms 18:30, "As for Yahweh, his way is perfect. The way of Yahweh is tried. He is a buckler to all those that trust in him." And I'm going to leave it at that. That's going to be our memory scriptures. The word perfect is the main word we're after. And so now we're going to go to the symbolization of the seventh seal, because seven is a complete and perfect number. And Laodicea, the Seventh-day Adventist Church, represents number seven. And in order for her to have that description of being perfect, she has to produce the 144,000, which the number seven is a symbolical number of the 144,000, meaning completeness and perfection. "And when he had opened the seventh seal," I'm on page 63 now of the To the Seven Churches, "there was silence in heaven about the space of half an hour. And I saw the seven angels which stood before Yahweh, and unto them were given seven trumpets. And another angel came and stood at the altar, having a golden censer, and it was given unto him much incense, that he should offer it with the prayers of all saints upon the golden altar, which was before the throne, and the smoke of the incense which came with the prayers of the saints ascended up before Yahweh out of the angel's hand. And the angel took the censer, and filled it with fire of the altar, and cast it into the earth, and there were voices, and thunderings, and lightning, and an earthquake. And the seven angels, which had the seven trumpets, prepared themselves to sound." Revelation 8:1-6. "After the time for the judicial demonstration," let's do that again. "After a time, the judicial demonstrations, the voices is saying, Holy, 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 Yahweh Elohim Almighty, the thunderings and the lightnings cease for the space of half an hour," very definitely indicating that the judicial throne of the first session of the judgment adjourned. Following this, the seven angels are given the seven trumpets. In the meantime, the angel who stands at the altar offers the prayers of all saints, takes the censer, fills it with fire from the altar, and casts it into the earth. Then it is that the heaven-born fire, the thunderings and lightnings and voices, the heaven-born, B-O-R-N, fire, the thunderings and lightnings and voices, which the first session of the judgment opened in the heavenly sanctuary, Revelation 4 and 5, descend to the earth in reverse order. Voices, thunderings, lightnings, Revelation 8 and 5, in addition unto which there is an earthquake. Then the seven trumpets sound, one following the other. At the sound of the seventh trumpet, not at the breaking of the seventh seal, there are great voices saying, the kingdoms of this world are become the kingdoms of our the Savior, of our Elohim, the Father. It says, the kingdoms of this world are become the kingdoms of our Yahweh and of His Son, Yahshua. And He shall reign forever and ever, Revelation 11, 15. So when the time comes that His Son comes and takes His seat upon the throne of David, Luke 1:31-32, then that is when the Father and the Son comes and takes charge of the kingdoms of this world. And they reign forever and ever. Both of them working together, they reign forever and ever. For the half hour silence in between brings the voices down to earth, and at the sounding of the seventh trumpet, the mystery of Yahweh is finished. Revelation 10:7. Then it is that the kingdoms of this world are become the kingdoms of our Yahweh, of our Father. What does it all mean? Just this. As we have seen the silence divide, let's do that again. The kingdoms of the world are become the kingdoms of our Savior, Yahshua, the Messiah. And what does it all mean? Just this. As we have seen, the silence divides the two premillennial judicial sessions, the one for the dead and the other for the living. And the fire from the heavenly altar, the voices, lightnings, and thunderings descend to the earth. These facts, along with a number of scriptures on the subject, besides the remainder of the Revelation, the chapters after the breaking of the seventh seal prove that the judgment of the living, the cleansing of the earth's temple, is something which takes place on earth, not in heaven only. Behold, declares Yahweh, I will send my messenger, and he shall prepare the way before me, and Yahweh whom you seek shall suddenly come to his temple. But who may abide the day of his coming, and who shall stand when he appears? For he is like a refined fire and like full of soap. Malachi 3, 1 and 2. Yes, the work of the second judicial session includes the earthly sanctuary. The church at that time, the Yahweh's fire is in Zion and is furnished in Yahushua. Isaiah 31, 9. Okay, and many nations shall come and say, come and let us go up to the mountain of Yahweh and to the house of the Elohim of Jacob, and he will teach us of his ways, and we will walk in his paths, for the law shall go forth of Zion, and the word of Yahweh from Jerusalem. And he shall judge and make many people, and rebuke strong nations afar off, and they shall beat their swords into plowshares, and their spears into pruning hooks. Nation shall not lift up a sword against nation, neither shall they learn war any more. But they shall set every man under his vine and under his fig tree, and none shall make them afraid, for the mouth of Yahweh of the host Yahshua of the host has spoken it. Micah 4:2-4. Then shall he sit upon the throne of his glory, and before him shall be gathered all nations, and he shall separate them one from another, as a shepherd divideth his sheep from the goats. And he shall sit the sheep on his right hand, but the goats on the left. Then shall the king say unto them on his right hand, Come, ye blessed of my Father, inherit the kingdom prepared for you from the foundation of the world. Then shall he say also unto them on the left hand, Depart from me, ye cursed, into everlasting fire, prepared for the devil and his angels. Matthew 25:31-41. And the kingdom and dominion and the greatness of the kingdom under the whole heaven shall be given unto the people of the saints of the Most High, whose kingdom is an everlasting kingdom, and all dominion shall serve and obey him. Hitherto is the end of the matter. Daniel 7:27-28. All these things definitely indicate the time in which every man shall cast away his idols of silver and his idols of gold. The very thing that caused the fall of the Assyrian, the power which rules Jerusalem, at the time Elohim delivers his people, Isaiah 31:7-8, the truth therefore is trouble-free. Between the judgment of the dead and the judgment of the living stands a half hour silence, the time absorbed in bringing the first judicial session to a close. So when did that happen? Between the judgment of the dead and the judgment of the living stands a half hour silence. Judgment of the dead ended in 2002, Charlotte, Texas. Closing out the sixth seal, so, and the sixth trumpet, everything, sixes, came to a close. All the sevens began in 2002, a tournament. At the end of Laodicea's allotted time, the seventh candlestick. The time absorbed in bringing the first judicial session to a close and in preparing for the second session. The remaining verses of chapter 8 also, chapters 9 to 11, give a description of the seven trumpets. And what happened at tournament in 2001? We had the 9/11 take place there in New York City. On the ninth day of September, see, 9/11, see. On the ninth month, I believe, it's what they call it, the 11th day of the ninth month, 2001, we had the 9/11. Well, here it is right here in Revelation, 9/11. Between the chapters 9 and 11 give a description of the seven trumpets. A full treatise of which is found in tract number 5, The Final Warning. We are now brought to chapter 12 of the Revelation, which deals with the subject of the everlasting, or the ever-living church and her enemy. The first of these to come in review at the throne of the judgment is the ever-living church. And there appeared a great wonder in heaven, a woman clothed with the sun and the moon under her feet, and upon her head a crown of 12 stars. And she being with child cried, travailing in birth and pain to be delivered. And there appeared another wonder in heaven, and behold a great red dragon, now that's Lucifer, having seven heads, meaning that he's in charge of all the churches here on earth, the organized churches, and 10 horns, meaning all nations, 10 is universal, 7 is complete, 7 all churches and all nations, and 7 crowns upon his heads, 7 crowns upon the heads of, upon those 7 heads, which represents all churches. And his tail drew the third part of the stars of heaven and did cast them onto the earth. And the dragon stood before the woman which was ready to be delivered, for to devour her child as soon as it was born. And she brought forth a man-child, who was to rule all nations with a rod of iron. And her child was called upon the Yahweh and to his son. And the woman fled into the wilderness, where she had the place prepared of Yahweh, that they should feed her 1,260 days. Revelation 12:1-3. It is clear to see that this woman was clothed with the sun and attacked by the dragon, even before her child Yahshua was born. Yes, years before the Christian church and the gospel came into being. To say then that she represents the New Testament church clothed with the gospel of the Yahshua is indeed as ungrounded and as illogical a theory as to say that the chicken is hatched before the egg is laid. Clothed with the sun, the woman is Elohim's ever-living church clothed with the light from heaven. The Bible, thy word, says the psalmist, is a light unto my path. Psalms 119:105. For the moon, as we know, is the medium by which sunlight is reflected and the night lightened. Being under the woman's feet, it is the most fitting symbol of the period before the Bible came into being, the period from creation unto Moses. This phase of the symbolism very definitely points out that the woman was emerging from the period of which the word Yahweh the Son was indirectly reflected, was passed on from the Father the Son, and that she was entering into the period in which she was clothed with the Yahweh's light, the Bible. Moreover, she was with child at the time she was clothed with the sun, and the moon stood under her feet. This in itself positively displays that at her outset, she represents the church after it had received the promise to bring forth the world's Redeemer, the man-child, who was to rule all nations with a rod of iron. He was caught up under Yahweh and under his throne. He is Yahshua, the Messiah. For the 12 stars that comprise the woman's crown most obviously bespeaks Elohim's government upon the earth, the church's cumulative authority, that of the 12 patriarchs of the 12 tribes of the 12 apostles, and of the 12,000 out of each of the 12 tribes of Israel, the 144,000. It is also to be observed that she portrays the ever-living church of Elohim while in combat with the enemy. Okay, and there appeared another wonder in heaven, and behold, a great red dragon, having 7 heads and 10 horns and 7 crowns upon his head, and his tail drew the 3rd part of the stars of heaven, and did cast them to the earth, and the dragon stood before the woman, which was ready to be delivered for to devour her child as soon as it was born. Verses 3 and 4. If the student of the heavens inspired truth is to know the object lesson that is taught by this symbolism, he should now carefully notice the significance which the dragon's crownless horns and his crowned heads carry. Also, if the student of the truth is to profit by what the scriptures teach, he should fully realize that the preceding as well as the following scriptural and logical considerations must be heeded. To begin with, since the dragon's horns are a group of 10, they must depict all the kings or kingdoms in present, just as the 10 toes of the great image of the Daniel, chapter 2, and also the 10 horns of the beast of chapter 7 represent the kings or kingdoms existing universally in their respective periods. Now, it should be overlooked the fact that all the horns, heads, and crowns were there grouped together when the dragon stood ready to devour her child, exactly as the symbolism reveals. They do symbolize a coalition of two separate and distinct parties, horns and heads, both existing at the same time, not one following the other. It is well to remember, too, that though the horns grow up and drop out, heads never do. God, for a correct interpretation of the symbolical horns and heads. This is our next subtitle. For the dragon's horns being crownless, they must picture a type of rulers similar to those symbolized by the crownless horns of Daniel's fourth beast, of his goat and ram, and of John's scarlet colored beast, and of two horned beasts. That is, the dragon's crownless horns indicate crownless authorities of some type, just as do the crownless horns of any other symbolical beast. For example, the 10 crownless horns of Daniel's fourth beast, the angel explained, depict kings that were yet to arise from the Roman Empire, were yet to take their crowns later. However, the horned head, having lost its power, and the envisioned kings having received their kingdom, they are thereafter represented by the crown horns, by the horns of the leopard-like beast, Revelation 13, a world symbol after the fall of Rome. Again, the 10 crownless horns of the scarlet-colored beast, Revelation 17, the beast, which at length succeeds the leopard-like, portrays kings that have received no kingdom as yet, but received power as kings 1 hour with the beast. So this is what's going on right now. Our Congress and our Senate giving a blank check to the President Obama to run our government instead of with a two-party system. He run it with a dictatorship, with a one-party system, and that's his party. Revelation 17:12. In other words, having no kingdom of their own, all the while Babylon rides, rules the beast for 1 hour, the horns are nationally crownless. So the kingdoms of this world have given their power to this beast. And they have taken their crowns off and set them up on a shelf, or they give them to the beast. They don't have a crown, showing that they have relinquished their power to rule like an independent parliamentary king would rule. Since these 10 horns came into existence as a group, they therefore represent contemporary rulers. Alright, so they came into existence as a group, meaning they all showed up on the scene at one time saying, hey, I'll give my power to you, Pope Francis. I'll give my power to you in the Vatican. They all showed up at the same time. When horns represent powers that exist, one following the other, inspiration does not fail to so indicate by showing certain horns coming up and others dropping out. For example, 3 of the horns of Daniel's fourth beast were plucked up by the roots. And in their stead, a notable horn head came up in like manner. When the goat's great horn broke off, 4 came up to take its place. And the 5th one, the exceeding great horn, followed thereafter, Daniel 7 and 8. Then too, even the beast himself, that in their respective periods portray the world, came out of the sea, one following the other. Thus, all divine symbolization exhibit the powers precisely as time and events cause them to appear or to disappear, as the case may be. In other words, when one power differs from another, and when they do or do not exist at the same time, inspiration never overlooks making the distinction. If it did overlook doing so, then think how illogical, inconsistent, and incomprehensible its teachings would indeed be, and how few to offer anyone even the attempt to know the exact truth. Human wisdom has already demonstrated its inability of itself to comprehend the mysteries of Yahweh's word, even though they be delineated as perfect, as only Yahweh himself can delineate the word. There's that word perfect again. That's our memory word for today. In fact, the longer a person on his own initiative tries to explain the mysteries of Yahweh, the further away from the truth he drifts. Moreover, it is not possible that the inspiration would be so illogical as to group two different elements, those depicted by the horns and those depicted by the heads, to represent one form of government. Neither is it conceivable that it would group horns and heads together if both did not literally exist at the same time. No, inspiration would not thus confuse its terms and still expect us to comprehend its teaching. To know how to interpret its symbol and when to expect the actual events to take place. And how logical would it be if the powers represented by the horns and the powers represented by the heads did not vary in character as much as do real horns and heads? As unto the denotation of the heads, inspiration itself being the only source of information, we again go to the prophecy of the Daniel 7. There it is seen that the fourth beast, little horn, having the eyes and a mouth of man, actually was a horn head, a combination of two separate elements, and it being symbolical of the church and state government, a combination of the civil and religious powers during the Middle Ages. Settles beyond doubt that while the horn part stands for the civil phase, the head part stands for the religious phase. Logically, too, because religion should be the brains of any government. Furthermore, our civil governments were originally founded upon the church governments. For the symbolism thus clearly connotes that an anatheistic government is about as good as is any horn apart from its head. Such might even be compared unto a chicken with its head cut off. In its flight, the headless chicken jumps with great force, but it knows not where it is going, and it lives but a few minutes. Moreover, the government following after the civil authority was torn away from the religious political setup of the Middle Ages. It is brought to view in the symbolism of the leopard-like beast, the one that sequentially follows in the line of the beast symbolism. In it, the religious political governments having been dissolved is shown by a common wounded head, a religious system without civil authority, one suffering from a deadly blow, obviously, from the blow which tore away a civil authority. From these considerations, it is particularly noticeable that in all instances where the symbolical beast have both horns and heads, the heads in every instance symbolize ecclesiastical bodies, bodies that have to do with the things of the Yahweh that are likely to commingle the sacred things of the Yahweh with the common things of the world. For the name of blasphemy over the heads of the leopard-like beast exposes them as having committed that very sin. And now continuing with the subject of the dragon, it can be clearly seen that in order that consistency be maintained, the biblical interpretation of the dragon's heads and horns must be that the former are religious bodies and the latter civil governments. And how many of them do the dragon's horns and heads depict? All the civil governments and all the religious bodies at that specific time. How do we know this? Because there are 10 horns. And 7 crowned heads. And because the biblical number 10 denotes universality, and the number 7 denotes completeness, see tract number 3, The Judgment and the Harvest, page 94, from the aforementioned example, we already see that the time has come for all faithful Bible students, students after saving the truth, to realize that inspiration never does anything vain or careless. Its work is ever accurately constructed, always dependable at face value, and explicit beyond improvement. It is a recognized fact, too, that crowns always stand for a kingly authority. And as they appear on the dragon's heads, not on his horns, it is especially noticeable that while the dragon ruled both the civil and the religious worlds, yet he crowned the religious. In other words, the church held a scepter. The church sat on the dragon's throne. And the fact that the number of the dragon's horns represent universality, and the number of his crowned heads, completeness, coupled with the fact that both the Jewish church and the Romans persecuted the Yeshua shows that the dragon as a whole represents a complete satanic ecclesiastical world, that Satan had taken the world captive as a conqueror of it, and armed with the horns and heads, he moved upon Herod to kill the newborn children as soon as he learned of the Yahshua's birth. This he did with the hope of destroying the Savior, devouring the child, and thereby perpetuating his own kingdom. Such was the condition of the world at Yahshua's first advent. And thus was the church enabled to crucify Yahshua, to stone Stephen, to behead others, and yet to escape the penalties of the civil authority. For this very reason, the Son of Man, the world's Redeemer, came just when he did. The dragon, though, to defend his satanic dominion, patiently waited and carefully watched for the arrival of the world's promised Redeemer. So it was that while the ever-living church of the Yahweh was with the child and crying to be delivered, the dragon with his 7 crowned heads and 10 horns stood ready to devour the child as soon as he was born. Now do you wonder why the Pharisees, Sadducees, all the scribes, there on Capitol Hill in Jerusalem, and 2,000 years ago when Yahshua was born, now you see why they were all against him? Because the old devil had taken charge of all of them. Just such apostasy had gripped the world in the days of Noah, too, and made it necessary for the Yahshua to do something to save the world. I'm not talking about Yahshua, our Savior. He had to do something back then. People don't realize that Yahshua operated in the Old Testament. Well, he was born in the Old Testament. The New Testament didn't begin until after his death on the cross. to do something to save the world. Yahshua lived 33 years in the Old Testament. When he was born on this earth, he closed out the last 33 years of the Old Testament period. For the sake of mankind, the Creator sent the flood to bring an end unto the wickedness. In like manner, the terrible apostasy of the Jews in the days of Yahshua's first advent demanded another disaster as thoroughly destructive as the dreadful deluge, in order again to blot out wickedness. But if for no other reason than to keep his never-failing promise to his faithful servant Noah, Elohim could not thus overthrow the world a second time. And so he sent his son to die in the world's stead. In this light, how much brighter than ever stands forth the Redeemer's mission. By his death, did he indeed save the world from the destruction at that time? And by his resurrection, did he make possible for it to stand today? And you have to answer absolutely yes. Now we're going to go to the Bible, the Revelation. And his tail drew the third part of the stars of heaven and did cast them to the earth. And the dragon stood before the woman, which was ready to be delivered, to devour her child as soon as it was born. Okay. And there was war in heaven. Michael and his angels fought against the dragon, and the dragon fought and his angels and prevailed not. Neither was their place found any more in heaven. And the great dragon was cast out, that old serpent called the devil and Satan, which deceived the whole world. He was cast out into the earth, and his angels were cast out with him. When the dragon saw that he was cast unto the earth, he persecuted the woman, which brought forth the man-child. Verse 4, 7 to 9, and 13, that's in Revelation 12. Here are described two different casting out. Note that in the first instance, the dragon drew the angels with his tail. But you wonder, why not with his claws? Simply because such would falsely indicate that Satan defeated the Yahshua and consequently dragged out of heaven a third of the angels. But since he drew them with his tail, the true significance is clear, that a third part of the angels voluntarily followed him. They clung to his tail, so to speak, while he led the way. Now, Vicki Oliver is leaving out a very good point here. He should also point out that Lucifer voluntarily left heaven, and a third of the angels in heaven that he had deceived voluntarily followed him to this earth, knowing that Yahshua was due to be born here on this earth. And so they voluntarily came on their own at the time that they knew the prophecy was time for the Messiah to be born here on earth, and so they waited for him to be born. So how could they have any battle with him if he was still undisclosed to view here on earth until after he was born? Then they could line up and try to do something about destroying him. Let's go ahead. They turned from the Father and from his Son and united with the instigator of the rebellion. Testimony of Volume 3, page 115. The dragon persuaded the angels, and they followed him from heaven to earth, whereupon he sought to devour Yahshua. This incident of verse 4, the dragon drawing down the stars, preceded the incident of verse 9. Yahshua casting down the dragon. The former took place before the Yahshua was born. Okay, that's what I'm saying. That's what I just said. And Vicki Hollis did go ahead and make this point here that I thought he hadn't made. It says, the former took place before the Yahshua was born, and the latter after his resurrection. So, Satan and his angels followed down to earth voluntarily 33 years before they followed him back to heaven. Or in other words, they followed him here to earth to be born. They followed him back to heaven 33 years later. And that's when Yahshua overcame them and cast them out of heaven. This is made manifest in the following paragraph. In the days of Job, Satan still had access to heaven, for we are told that there was a day when the sons of Yahweh came to present themselves before the Yahweh, and Satan came also among them. And the Yahweh said unto Satan, Whence comest thou? And Satan answered Yahweh and said, From going to and fro in the earth, and from walking up and down in it. Job 1:6-7. Satan then was cast out of heaven immediately after he rebelled, or even when he caused Adam and Eve to sin. Rather, it must have been after Job's time. But to determine this, when we shall read verse 13, And when the dragon saw that he was cast unto the earth, he persecuted the woman which brought forth the man-child. He therefore was cast out before he went to persecute the church. This he did at the time that there was a great persecution against the church which was at Jerusalem, and they were all scattered abroad throughout the regions of Judea and Samaria, except the apostle. Acts 8:1. This fact is again borne out by the spirit of prophecy. Triumphantly, the Yeshua was caught up unto Yahweh and his son. All are there to welcome the Redeemer. They are eager to celebrate his triumph and to glorify their king. He presents to Yahweh the way sheep, those raised with him as representatives of that great multitude who shall come forth from the grave at his second coming. The voice of Yahweh is heard proclaiming that justice is satisfied. Satan is vanquished. Yahshua's toiling, struggling ones on earth are accepted in the Beloved before the heavenly angels and the representatives of the unfallen world. They are declared justified. Satan saw that his disguise was torn away. His administration was laid open before the unfallen angel and before the heavenly universe. He had revealed himself as a murderer by the shedding of the innocent blood of the Son of Yahweh. He had uprooted himself from the sympathies of the heavenly being. Henceforth his work was restricted. Whatever attitude he might assume, he could no longer await the angels as they came from the heavenly court and before them accused Yahshua's brethren of being clothed with the garments of blackness and the defilement of sin. The last link of sympathy between Satan and the heavenly world was broken. It was Isaiah 8:33, 8:34, and 7:61. Okay, it says, Indeed, realizing that he had brought an end to his ever again in heaven, accusing the brethren and knowing that his stay even on earth was to be very short, Satan dropped down with great wrath. After the dragon was cast down, John heard a loud voice saying in heaven, Now has come salvation and strength, and the kingdom of our Elohim and the power of his Messiah, for the accuser of our brethren is cast down, which accused them before our Elohim day and night. And they overcame him by the blood of the Lamb and by the word of their testimony, and they loved not their lives unto the death. Therefore rejoice, ye heavens, and ye that dwell in them. Woe unto the inhabitants of the earth and of the sea, for the devil is come down unto you having great wrath, because he knoweth that he hath but a short time. Verses 10 to 12. Satan's accusation against those who seek the Yahshua are not prompted by displeasure at their sin. He exalts in their defective characters, for he knows that only through their transgression of Elohim's law can he obtain power over them. Prophets and Kings 585-586 by Ellen G. White. Satan, we see, encourages the sinner to unconsciously commit transgression, and thus to secure his condemnation not necessarily on earth, but in heaven, before the righteous judge. Satan accuses the transgressor being clothed with the garments of blackness. Okay, it says, and the defilement of sin, but when the spirit of Elohim prompts reproof, it reveals sin and rebukes the sinner through his church. Elohim's people should ever be on the alert for the voice of the spirit of Yahshua, as well as be on the guard to discern the spirit of the Satan. In the two clashes, the one strives for obedience to the Elohim's word, while the other excuses the sin and sympathizes with the sinner. In this latter subtle way, Satan often gains ground and wins the sinner to his ranks. For the sinner naturally loves his sin, the faithful, though, overcome him by the blood of the Lamb and by the word of testimony. They love not their lives unto the death, Revelation 12:11. And unto the woman were given two wings of a great eagle, that she might fly into the wilderness into her place, where she is nourished for a time and times and half a time from the face of the serpent, verse 14. Since a wilderness is just the opposite of a vineyard, the statement that she might fly into the wilderness emphatically implies that she must have left the vineyard, and that is precisely what she did. Shortly after the resurrection, the church, the woman, left the Holy Land, the vineyard, and went to the land of the Gentiles, the wilderness. Besides these historical facts, we have the biblical meaning of vineyard. The vineyard of Yahshua, the host, is the house of Israel. And the men of Judah, his pleasant plant, Isaiah 5:7. I'll put that again. I'll add the preposition. Well, the vineyard of the Yahshua of the host is in the house of Israel. And the men of Judah, his pleasant plant. Unquestionably, therefore, the wilderness where the woman was nourished for the time being is in the land of the Gentiles. I add the preposition there, in the land of the Gentiles, and the woman having to flee from the face of the dragon in her homeland shows that the dragon had made the Holy Land his headquarters. Not satisfied with this, though, he even followed her into the wilderness, and that's where he's at today. The wilderness today translates into the geographical location of Texas, where we're at today, setting up the kingdom. He would naturally follow wherever the kingdom is going to be set up, and the kingdom of death may be set up right here in Liberty Hill, Texas, for its headquarters for these last days here in the United States, which is over all the wilderness of the people in prophecy. And the serpent cast out of his mouth water as a flood after the woman, that he might cause her to be carried away of the flood, verse 15. In the hope of destroying the woman, the serpent at first persecuted her. Failing down to reach his goal, he suddenly reversed his tactics. He ceased the persecution and began instead to befriend her. But at what cost to the woman? Cunningly, he cast water as a flood after her, seeming to put forth a mighty effort to refresh her, when in actuality it was a mighty effort thereby to destroy her. The figurative words of inspiration explain that the compulsory Christianizing of the Gentiles and the pouring of them into the church during the 4th century, talking about the church of the Catholic Church, of the Christian era, was not in reality a friendly act. Rather, it was like a devastating torrent to drown the saving power of the Christianity. In other words, inspiration predicted the period in which the dragon clothed pagan politicians in a garb of Christianity and then led them to compel the non-Christian pagan to join the church, that they might thus paganize her rather than she Christianize them. In the confirmation, we quote a partial description from Mr. Gibbons' work, by the Edicts of Toleration, He, Constantine, removed the temporal disadvantages which had hitherto retarded the progress of Christianity, and its active and numerous ministers received a free permission, a liberal encouragement to recommend the salutary truths of the revelation by every argument which could affect the reason or piety of mankind. But the exact balance of the two religions, Christian and pagan, continued but a moment. For the cities which signalized their forward zeal by the voluntary destruction of their temples, the pagans, were distinguished by their municipal privileges and rewarded with the popular donatives. For the salvation of the common people was purchased at an easy rate. If it be true that in 1 year 12,000 men were baptized at Rome, besides the proportionable number of women and children, and that a white garment with 20 pieces of gold had been promised by the emperor unto every convert, this was the law of Constantine, which gave freedom to all the slaves who should embrace Christianity. You'll find that information in Gibbon's Rome, volume 2, page 273-274. And the earth helped the woman, and the earth opened her mouth and swallowed up the flood which the dragon cast out of his mouth. Verse 16. The earth, Elohim's mighty weapon, is finally to help the woman. It is to swallow up the flood. That is the same divine means which, according to the parable, takes away the terrors and burns them. Likewise, takes away all who have joined the church, but who are still pagan at heart. And what happens then? The scriptures supply the answer. The dragon was wroth at the woman and went to make war with the remnant of her seed, which keep the commandments of the Yahweh and have the testimony of Yahshua Messiah. Verse 17. But the term remnant discloses that her seed is divided into two parts. The one is taken, the other is left. Nehemiah, for example, explains. The remnant that are left of the captivity there in the province are in great affliction and reproach. Nehemiah 1:3. A remnant always represents one part of the whole, either large or small. And notice that the dragon wars not against the remnant of the flood, but against the remnant of her seed. Yahshua, being the woman's only child, her seed, are therefore the Christians, those who are born into the Christian church through the spirit of the Yahshua. Accordingly, the act of taking the first fruits under Mount Zion, Revelation 14:1, brings about a condition which makes a remnant of those who are still left among the Gentiles. In this instance, therefore, they, the second fruits, are the remnant. Let it be remembered that it is after the earth swallows the flood that the dragon is to be wroth with the woman and to make war with the remnant of her seed, not with her personally, which keep the commandments of Elohim and have the testimony of Yahshua Messiah. Revelation 12:16-17. Truly then, there is no escaping the conclusion that doing away with the Satan's flood is doubtless the purifying of the church, the destroying of those who have joined the church through the aid of the serpent. This purifying is the very thing that enables the church as a body to keep the commandments of Elohim and also to have the testimony of Yahshua Messiah, the living spirit of prophecy, Revelation 19:10, in her midst. This is her only hope, her only strength, her only deliverance. And this light, inspiration, now puts new life into the word. Awake, awake, put on thy strength, O Zion, put on thy beautiful garments, O Jerusalem, the holy city. For henceforth there shall no more come into thee the uncircumcised and the unclean. Isaiah 52:1. The church's purification, therefore, will not bring the millennial time of peace. Indeed not, but it will bring the end of the wicked in the church, and with it Satan's greatest wrath against the remnant, against those who are still among the Gentiles, thereafter to take their stand on the Yahshua's side. They shall nevertheless be delivered if they, as it were, risk their lives, if they take their stand on the Yahshua's side and thereby put their names in the book, Daniel 12:1. For the dragon cannot war with the woman, the church that is made up of the first fruits, because at that time She is with the Lamb on Mount Zion, Revelation 14:1, and out of the dragon's reach. Okay, so for the further study on Revelation 12, read the tract number 12, The World Yesterday, Today, and Tomorrow, 45-48 pages. Okay, though the subject matter of the Revelation has only partially been treated as herein, the limited space in this tract does not permit me to go further, but I will continue on this subject myself, Elijah David, from where Ricky Hollis left off. I'll continue it on, possibly, in our next study. Okay, I'm going to close this service now with a song that I've written entitled Mountain Peaks Are Hard to Climb, Crossing Rivers at Any Time, to make a person very weary if his heart is not in tune. But I know at the journey's end we will meet our dearest friend, and the welcome sign will read, There's Plenty of Room. Things do happen, don't you know? Crossing the river, you gotta go slow. Mountain peaks are just another hill to climb. Every day's burdens come along, meet them with a smile and a song. For there's nothing that replaces peace of mind. Mountain peaks are hard to climb, crossing rivers at any time. Make a person very weary if his heart is not in tune. But I know at the journey's end we will meet our dearest friend, and the welcome sign will reach us plenty of room. In this world in which we live, oftentimes we must forgive many things and try to really understand. That it's not the one who takes, but the one that yawns and makes, and the character is the measure of a man. Not in peace, hard to find, crossing rivers at any time, make the person very weary if his heart is not in tune. But I know at the journey's end, we will meet our dearest friend. And the welcome sign will be this pain of room. So there's no need to worry, there's no need to stew and fret. There's no need to worry about the things that hasn't happened yet. Just a matter of time, and all things will have your end. Praise the Yah, hallelujah, that the new will begin. Mountain peaks are hard to climb, crossing rivers at any time. Make a person very weary if this heart is not in tune. But I know at the journey's end, we will meet our dearest friend, and the world.